Is my mulishness with Latin that obvious? But she was still intent on what she was saying. The mental spaciousness went beyond his kind portrayal of a Jewish character. Abelard attacked the ideology that made attacks on Jews inevitable. Not ideology, theology. He invented that word, too. Did you know that? No, he said. How do you know it? I told you. My father. The thought of him made her stop. As she put the cigarette to her lips, she saw that her fingers were trembling slightly. In this priest's presence, she was strangely buffeted by an unprecedented impulse to reveal herself, which, at this moment, meant revealing her father and her father's hero. I told you, she repeated, I was my father's helper. At Cluny, he tracked down other writings by Abelard, records of disputations and councils, anonymous treatises, and notations of his students. Abelard inevitably criticized Jews for rejecting Christ, and my father's Catholic critics emphasized that. But my father saw that Abelard's innovation went further, to the very idea of God. His concern was with God, which is why he coined that word, theology. For Abelard, everything follows from the first principle. The Creator loves what the Creator creates. Creation itself is God's act of love. You said something like that the other day, Kavanaugh recalled, that we're saved by virtue of being created. No church is needed, no Jesus, just creation. Including Jews, she said. The priest said nothing to that, and for a moment Rachel feared that he'd taken offense, or worse, that he was appalled. But then he spoke, and she saw that she was wrong. He said quite simply, "The idea stuck with me. I tried to work that expansiveness into my sermon this morning, not successfully." Now his smile did have the aspect of a grin, and she was relieved to sense his self-deprecation. At Good Shepherd, he continued, the pews were full of blank stares. "It is not such a hard idea," Rachel said softly. "Actually, for us, it is. Jesus matters, obviously, I mean, matters to us." "Of course, but your theology, avec tout mon respect, mon père, follows from a fork in the road, a fork lit up by burning texts. There was another way to go at that fork, one the church chose not to take." She extinguished what little remained of her cigarette. "That, at least, is what my father saw. He wanted the Catholics of France of his own time to claim this great Catholic champion from another time. Because of what was happening to Jews in your father's time." "Obviously," Rachel said, picking up his word. "Which was my time, too." She regretted the edge in her voice as soon as she heard it, but she had stopped herself from saying, "When more than texts were burned." She disliked herself. She was lecturing this man, had been lecturing him all along. After a long silence, Kavanaugh asked, "What was your father's name?" "Saul Vedette, a professor at the Sorbonne." "Jacques Maritain was at the Sorbonne," Kavanaugh said. "The Catholic philosopher, he was a big deal in our seminary studies. My father knew him. Perhaps they were friends, I do not know. Once the Germans came, Professor Maritain fled to New York. Had he stayed in Paris, he might have helped my father. Unlike those who remained, I do not know. Back then, getting out, Professor Maritain saw what I failed to see. My father and I stayed in Paris because we thought we needed medicine from the nearby chemist. But of course there are many ways to get medicine, as I learned." She paused, blanking from her mind that particular memory. Then she said, "We could have left." There came a moment when, had I insisted, she blanked as well the hate-filled face of the bald inquisitor in the threshold of their apartment. My father would have agreed to leave. I misread the moment and encouraged him to stay, to continue with his great work. I failed to imagine what was coming. At the start, she looked away, then added more quietly, and at the finish. A silence fell between them then. For a moment she feared that she was sounding like a Catholic penitent in one of their darkened booths. It panicked her to think the priest would now be pressing a confessor's questions, questions about her. But to her surprise, he asked simply, "Medicine? My father was diabetic. What happened to him?" Rachel clasped her hands, a decisive gesture of self-protection. She knew it was impossible for her to answer. She knew also that, with unwilled coyness, she had made that unspeakable question inevitable. Not dislike, but loathe. She loathed herself. Kavanaugh sensed that his question about her father had shut her down. Yet his inquiry had seemed natural, the result of an instinctive, pastoral feel for what she herself had wanted to discuss. A direct line from Abelard and his fate to solve the debt and his. But not so. He let his eyes drift around the tidy coffee shop. The other tables, as usual, were empty. The waitress was hovering behind the counter, intermittently eyeing the clock and idling through a magazine. He brought his gaze back to Rachel Vedette, who was focused on smoke rising from his cigarette in the ashtray. He said, "Professor Vedette sounds like a very special man." She did not react. He said, "May I tell you about my father?" Rachel looked up, surprise having brightened her face. She said, "No one in America has ever said that to me." He said, "Pop was not special, except to us, his kids. Big Irish family. He was a lumper." Registering her quizzical look, he added, "A stevedore. We lived on 38th Street, Hell's Kitchen, near the West Side Docks. That's been prettified by now, with a stretch of midtown piers for the big liners mostly. Swell people, wanting to arrive back from the Grand Tour within a short cab ride of the plaza. Before the war, the dock trade was farther south in Chelsea. Pop would show up at the wharves in the morning without a job, hoping to be tapped. 3 days out of five he would be, unloading everything from steamer trunks to furniture to automobiles to bricks of salted meat and smoked fish. I can still smell the stench off my father's overalls, everything from motor oil to mackerel. But if he were here, he would sum up a lifetime of lashing barrels and hooking crates by telling you he helped unload the ship that had plucked survivors out of the sea after the Titanic." The Titanic? Her surprise was complete. Yes. He never stopped talking about that day. 40,000 New Yorkers showed up to stand on the docks when that accidental rescue ship pulled in, all completely silent. My father was given mooring lines to man. The ship came into its slip with no whistles, no horns, no sounds. They dropped the gangway, he said, without the usual noise. The first ones to disembark were the Titanic people. Pop said it was like watching a line of the Walking Dead come down the planks. Hundreds of them, many still wearing blankets like cloaks. Dead people, he said, brought back to life, but barely. Their eyes, he said, were incapable of blinking. Mostly it was women and children. He never got over it. Kavanaugh stopped. After a moment he said, "Goodness, how did I veer into that?" Rachel said unsteadily. Yes, I ask myself that. How did you? She stared at him, deciphering. Then she said, The image is striking. Le débarquement of the dead. She pulled her own pack of cigarettes from her pocket, and with an agitation that made him think of her rush from the museum the other day, she had to strike her match repeatedly to get the flame. He recalled the womanly ease with which she'd leaned to his flame earlier, but he now understood that he should hold back from offering a match again. He knew not to intrude on whatever it was that had come over her. Finally, she regained her composure and said, You report that so powerfully, but you were... I was an infant, but that day was famous in our family. The older Pop got, the more he talked about it. He'd mock himself and say that the shipwreck survivors cured him of the wish to go to sea. But we knew from Mom what a turning point it was. He quit drinking that day. She told us proudly that he never hit her again. He went to Mass every morning after that. Still, he never went up to communion because, as he would say, he felt unworthy. Somehow in his mind, the gangplank Walking Dead and his unworthiness were linked. But in fact, he was a good man, and we all saw it. Odd, but our admiration for him, not to say affection, was tied to the Titanic. Again, Kavanaugh stopped. He was astounded at himself. He had not spoken in this way of such things in years to anyone. But he knew that his thought was unfinished. He said, We were humble people, but it lent us a kind of grandeur, the Titanic, that such a historic event should have touched us so personally. As I grew up, I would dream about those people on the gangplank, with their eyes unblinking, as if I'd been there. I had that dream not long ago. Rachel said quietly, A parable of empathy. How a mere glimpse of such suffering changed your father. She spoke smoothly, having stifled her first reaction. She added, Perhaps it explains something about yourself? Kavanaugh laughed, claiming nothing, as if to scale back on the tragic grandiosity of what he'd reported. He resumed speaking, but more mundanely. I have three sisters and two brothers, one nun, Sister Teresa, one tugboat captain, Jerry, one office girl, Marie, one Brooklyn housewife, Sheila. Let's see, how many is that? Four, she said. You have neglected one. My brother Joe. Kavanaugh nodded gravely. I still count him. He died on Okinawa. After a long pause, Rachel asked, And your parents? Both deceased. My mother died of pneumonia 10 years ago, although my sisters swear she died of slow-motion grief. Pop had been taken off by a stroke years before that, but he was always part of us. Kavanaugh fell silent. Then he added, I am very lucky in my family. I can see that, she said, and your friendships? The man you were seeking? Runner? Kavanaugh laughed. He hardly remembered that nickname. It's so vivid to me, like yesterday. He's a good man, too, a teacher. He showed up at Good Shepherd last week in the middle of some personal distress. Thrown for a loop, she said. Yes, him too, Kavanaugh laughed. But he's handling it. For me, seeing him was a big relief, a recovery of something I'd thought I'd lost, though it gives me some big business to tend to. Whether I can handle it is to be determined. He raised his brows. It's more than you want to know. But actually, you helped me the other day. I was stuck, and you told me to just get moving, and so then I did. He moved his hand to her book, covering it. I brought this with me to New Jersey. You gave it to me, you said, so that we could discuss it. But your book accompanied me. She nodded. It accompanies me. That is precisely what it does. He sensed the block between them, what she would not or could not discuss. But he sensed also that that discussion had, perhaps, begun. He said, On Mondays, the biggest ocean liners set sail from the West Side Terminal. Did you know that? No. Have you ever seen an ocean liner set sail? It's a festival. When I was a kid, it's what we did instead of the circus. It's still one of the best things in New York, he grinned, and it's free. She did not reply. The Cloisters Museum is closed tomorrow? He asked. Yes. I told you, he said. Tomorrow is my day off, too. Would you let me show you? Three long, deafening blasts on the horn, then the ship inches away from the pier while all the dockside well-wishers are waving goodbye. The bands are playing, the whistles blow, people laugh and sing, the ship eases out, and when at last it's gone, everybody cries, it's grand, only in New York. Plus, I could take you around my old neighborhood. She smiled. Then, after a long time and more quietly still, she said, How could I resist, Father? Chapter 18 To his most beloved lady, the memory of whom no forgetting can steal away, her most faithful one, may the first time I forget your name be when I no longer remember my own. Eloise looked up from the page. Its edges were yellow. Creases broke the page into quarters. It was one of his letters, written more than a decade before when letters had flown between them. While waiting for the abbot, she had, as she often did, drawn the folded parchment from inside her habit, less to read than simply to hold, her true periopt. Indeed, her eyes floated up from the letter to drift through the cloister arcade to the rustic panorama beyond the solarium, granary, and barns, where neatly ordered vineyards sloped down to the river basin. Its silvery water justified the name of the place, Argentoy, her home. Within 4 years of her profession as a Benedictine nun here, she had been elected prioress. Everything Mother Eloise could see, including plow land stretching along the north bank of the Seine to the forested far hills, was hers. Young Sister Celestine appeared in the arched entranceway, breathless. 20 paces separated her from Eloise, who was seated near the central fountain of the cloister garden. The afternoon sun was gauzy with clouds, but the air was warm. Carefully trimmed hedges, bunched herbs, trellised roses, and potted jasmine stood between the women. "Father Abbot has arrived, Mother." The portress, at 20, was 2/3 the age of Eloise, yet rank juvenescence showed in her agitation. She well knew who Abbot Suger was, primate of Saint-Denis, the bishop's rival, competing for preeminence as prelate of Paris. Eloise, by contrast to the young nun, was serene, though she knew that the abbot's sudden demand for an audience received by messenger only that morning could bode nothing but ill. Among the sisters of Argentoy, the habitual calm of their prioress seemed preternatural, a sign of sanctifying grace. To Eloise, though, unruffled self-possession was less a virtue than a tactic. Rather than respond to the young nun, Eloise dropped her eyes to the letter once more. Farewell, my beauty, you who are incomparably sweeter than all sweet things. May you prolong your years as happily as I wish for you, for nothing better is needed. Peter Abelard's words were all the blessing she would need. The parchment sheet fell easily into its creases as she folded it back into the sleeve hidden under her gray scapular, where, equally hidden, her golden ring rode on its cord. She pressed that lump against her breastbone to remember that she existed. She stood. Abbot Suger was a lean, tall man who, unusually for a monk, sported a thin mustache. It emphasized his tenebrous complexion, the stabbing darkness of his eyes, and the severe black of his religious garb. He habitually wore his cowl up, covering his head, and, more to the point, keeping his face in shadow. "I see you, you cannot see me," which was essential to his gift for intimidation. For a man of 50, he was fit and agile, with something martial in his bearing. He swept into the cloister garden with his robe swirling. Having removed his gloves, he pared them in his left hand and swatted his thigh as he strode. Because he wore heavy, ankle-high Norman shoes instead of sandals, his footfalls resounded. Approaching Eloise, he bowed. "Good day, Reverend Mother." Suger had been raised at Saint-Denis and had served as clerk to Abbot Adam, whom he succeeded the year after Peter Abelard was forced to leave that monastery. Everyone knew that the wily Suger had been the instrument of Abelard's expulsion, and he had ridden that wave of triumph over the once great master into the abbot's chair. Saint-Denis was less than an hour's ride from Argenteuil, and from the churning air with which the abbot arrived, Eloise understood that he had pushed his horse to get here quickly. When Suger wanted something, he did not hold back. Eloise returned his bow with one of her own. He did not offer his ring hand, nor did she betoken readiness to kiss it. With an easy curl of her forearm, she indicated both the marble stool on which her visitor should sit and the tray on which cups of barley tea and cider stood ready. "You are most welcome, Father," she said. Eloise knew that reserving the cushioned armchair for herself would not be lost on Suger, a prioress violating an abbot's primacy. Indeed, she counted on his taking note. "You honor us with your visitation." Eloise sat, arranging the skirts of her habit as she did so. A simple toss of her head settled the drapes of her veil across her shoulders. He sat. "You are gracious to receive me, Reverend Mother. I offer apologies for this intrusion." He dropped his gloves on the table beside the cups. Eloise declined to offer him refreshment. Absently, she touched her starched white coif, but in a way that drew Suger's eyes directly into her own. "How can I help you, Father Abbot?" "I fear I come with difficult words." Eloise only looked at him. "Shall I simply speak my piece?" She remained motionless. Suger pulled a scroll from inside his habit, an unknowing match to the parchment sheet that was hidden on her. "This decree commands the removal of your convent from Argenteuil." He offered the page to Eloise. She made no move to receive it. He opened the scroll and read, "The Holy Tribunal of the Metropolitan See of Sens in the Kingdom of France, in the 22nd year of the reign of Louis VI, being of the intention to proceed against disorder, mischief, and scandal, which increases to the prejudice of the Holy Faith, by command of the most eminent Lords Cardinal of this supreme and universal jurisdiction, and drawing on primacy recorded in the donation of Clovis I, hereby removes and dissolves the Priory of Notre Dame of Argenteuil. We pronounce, sentence, declare, and ordain the desacralization of the Benedictine Order of Argenteuil pending the reconsecration of the monastic foundation by the Benedictine Order of the Abbey of Saint-Denis, by order of and signed Henry, Archbishop of Sens, Samson, Archbishop of Reims, Stephen, Bishop of Paris. Suger let the scroll curl back into its tube. When he looked up, he was jolted, if only slightly, to see that the piercing eyes of Eloise had never left him. She was as still as a statue. "Well?" Suger said finally. Eloise said calmly, "This convent was founded by Princess Theodred, the daughter of Charlemagne, more than 300 years ago." "Yes, and Saint-Denis was founded more than 600 years before that by Dionysius the Areopagite, named in Acts as a convert of St. Paul." "I will leave that claim aside, Father. It is enough for me to observe that the monks of Saint-Denis, once each century, and always citing the spurious and long discredited donation of Clovis I, make this bid for Notre Dame, aiming to secure a port on the River Seine, not to mention the vineyards and contiguous demesne of Argenteuil. His Holiness the Pope always turns the essay back." "In this century, dear mother, His Holiness the Pope is particularly concerned to suppress the source of scandal at Argenteuil. The Pope furthermore affirms the donation. We have his writ. He is in France this very day." "Which Pope?" she asked calmly. The question was a jibe, because there were two papal claimants. She added, "Pope Innocent or Anacletus?" "Innocent is Pope, Innocent the Second." "But Father Abbot, am I wrong to understand that the Petrine succession is in dispute, speaking of disorder? Simple nuns are less well informed than holy monks, but word has come here that the cardinal electors deem Innocent's election uncanonical. Pope Anacletus is recognized in Rome. Hence, Innocent's flight northward across the Alps, so of course he is in France." The abbot replied, "Innocent is recognized by the emperor and, more to the point, by our own King Louis. And indeed, as you imply, a contested papal election is a matter beyond the competence of nuns in Lutetia." "But Innocent, obviously," she replied, "is beholden to you. Therefore, his writ lacks objectivity." "Mother, this dissemblance..." Eloise cut him off with a raised hand. "Notre Dame d'Argenteuil is under the patronage of Matilda, Countess of Champagne. Has her grace been informed of this interdict?" "King Louis the Sixth has been informed." "Louis the Fat, your schoolmate at Saint-Denis," she said. "You were boys of the bench together." "Mother, your disrespect makes my case. Need I remind you that your solemn vow of obedience and that of every woman in this convent is invoked? Disorder, mischief, and scandal? How dare you use such words of Argenteuil? What mischief? What scandal? I demand to know." Abbot Suger craned forward, and with a lowered voice he hissed, "The scandal here is well known." She said, "Canonical observance at Argenteuil is scrupulous in every regard. Consult your priests who serve as chaplains here. There is no disorder. I demand that you specify your indictment." Suger leaned back. "Look at you. Your very habit is a violation." She said, "The gray of our habit, the natural color of undyed wool, is an emblem of the simplicity for which we strive. Boiled wool and hemp cloth suffice." "Peasant clothing," he said. "The repeal of luxury, Father Abbot, defines our reform." "Reform, Ha! Vainglory, rather. To puff yourself up, you refuse the daughters of the well-born. Not true, she said. I refuse daughters who are sent here against their will. He said, instead, you receive women without dowry, which signifies their standing as harlots. Former harlots, yes, some, like the Gospel's own Mary of Magdala, perhaps, repentant, converted, several of our most devout sisters. Admitted to the choir, he said. We have abolished the distinction between choir nuns and lay sisters. Our women are equal before God, as your monks should be. Your lay brothers are no better than thralls. By what rule do you live? He asked. Your nuns work on manuscripts, not embroidery. You presume to run a school for female children. You admit externs to the cloister. Never, she said. We heal the sick who are brought to our gate. We feed the hungry, and yes, we teach girls, as I myself was taught here in the time of Mother Agnes. But our cloister is inviolable, an enclosure absolutely restricted to those who are professed. But Suger's litany rolled on as he ticked offenses off with his fingers. You instruct your sisters in writings of the pagans. You trade in Saracen texts. You forbid self-discipline, she interrupted with a sharply pointed finger. Self-flagellation, self-mutilation, yes, the whip and thorn, yes, I forbid that. Loving acceptance of the suffering attached to human life is all the corporal discipline we require. I forbid my sisters to torture themselves. Suger made a sharp gesture of his own, the cracking of a whip. Our Lord underwent flagellation freely. He accepted thorns. Are we not called to imitation? Benedictines share in the passion of Christ, that they might share in his kingdom. But you ignore Benedict's rule. You presume to substitute what? The rule of Eloise? Our house is reformed according to strict observance, Father. Magnum silentium, fast and abstinence, the counsels of perfection, the furthest thing from mischief. Again, I demand that you specify the indictment. Reverend Mother, I propose to spare you and your sisters the notoriety. But if you compel me, I will be merciless. I have consulted your chaplains. I am prepared to bring sworn testimony of holy men with certain knowledge of illicit, promiscuous, and decadent behavior by your women, one with another, and with themselves. Holy men, Abbot? Confessors? You would violate the sacred intimacy of the sacrament? No more than the examen of the chapter house does. Eloise stared at him. After all these years, an epiphany. Early in her time at Argenteuil, she had sensed that the tonsured men on the other side of the confessional screen, when presented with the once notorious Eloise, conjured lewd images and hoped to hear in her mea accusant details of her wicked, carnal history. If she had never, never openly regretted her behavior with Peter, it was for the simple reason that she had never repented of it. As for the opinions of the priests, once she was elected prioress, she had simply stopped presenting herself for confession. Now, with this threat from Abbot Suger to exploit the sacred forum, she understood why. Her instincts had been correct. She said calmly, if somewhat disingenuously, "My sisters regard the sacrament of penance as an encounter with Christ himself. Would he so betray them?" He said, Whosoever sins ye remit, they are remitted unto them, and whosoever sins ye retain, they are retained. Suger smiled the smile of self-satisfaction. He continued, Our Lord has given his ministers all authority to hold fast and to lay bare. Then use it, she said. Eloise stood, rattling the table, holding the cups of cider. Lay bare these charges. I demand a public accounting. You say the king knows of this interdict and its justification? I demand a hearing in the royal presence. If Pope Innocent is involved, I demand a reckoning before His Holiness. My sisters are absolutely innocent. You say they are whores? I challenge you. I have no fear. Your holy men will be shown up as blatant liars, and then Saint-Denis will be the source of disorder, mischief, and scandal, not Notre-Dame d'Argenteuil. Mother, you are blind to what is most obvious. Now it was Suger who was calm. He looked up at her from his stool. You are blind to your own standing in this matter. You yourself are the avatar of scandal never renounced. Your sister's primordial offense subsists in their disregard of your publica fama. The disgrace of Argenteuil began with your election as prioress, when you ceased being a penitential nun and became a false prophetess of virtue. I was never a penitential. Eloise felt heat come into her face. She had long secretly suspected that her fellow nuns had elected her, not despite her lewd history, but because of it. Your so-called husband was a penitential, with us, if only for a time. And what good came of that for him? Suger shrugged. We showed mercy to a man whose dismemberment was as much moral as physical. She said, Your predecessor admitted Peter Abelard because a Jew whose knowledge of herbal medicine the infirmarian coveted requested it. He said, Peter Abelard was a Jew's friend, yes. Eventually, that corruption, too, showed itself. What showed itself, she said, was Peter Abelard's application of critical reason to the fairy tales of the Abbey of Saint-Denis. You claim to have been founded by Dionysius the Areopagite, St. Paul's own convert. Peter Abelard, through careful study of history and scripture, showed that to be impossible. He reduced your creed to the absurd for which you banished him. Peter Abelard is degenerate, Mother, in thought as much as in deed. You are the living proof. The difference between you is that he has properly embraced his obscurity. Now it is time for you to embrace yours. Eloise, aware of the abbot's advantage in his equanimity, was desperate to check the surge of anger coursing through her. As the organizer of Peter Abelard's shaming eviction 8 years before, this man had been the object of her purest hatred, even before this new outrage. Yet those early years came back to her now, and for the needed brief interval, she took refuge in memory. Though her enclosure at Argenteuil and Peter's at Saint-Denis had been separated by only an hour's journey, she had never seen him. Yet she had been infinitely consoled to know that the same noonday sun made like shadows of their figures. The same rain fell on their upturned faces, and the same dark of night vaulted the ceilings above their narrow monastic pallets. With a fresh pang, she recalled Peter's torment. First, the long, inhealing catastrophe at the hands of Fulbert's henchmen. Then betrayal by the monastery to which he'd entrusted himself. Then, in the precincts of ecclesiastical power, almost universal disparagement, mockery, contempt. Once ostracized from Saint-Denis, and craving only solitude, he had built a hermitage a day's journey to the southeast, consecrating the place as the Paraclete, to rebut adversaries who accused him of denigrating in his theology the Holy Spirit. Worshipful would-be scholars blessed the young men, pursued him there, and the place grew willy-nilly into a true religious foundation. But enemies followed also, and the ever-famous Abelard was hounded away once again. The Paraclete fell derelict. Now he was ensconced on the far Atlantic coast as the abbot of a rough monastery of no importance on the wrong side of Christendom's most desolate frontier. Obscurity indeed. The great Peter Abelard, lost to the actual world forever. A chain of consequence that began with Abbot Suger, this man here in front of her, this villain. To calm herself, she put her hand to her breast, to touch through the fabric the folded letter. Farewell, my beauty, sweeter than all sweet things. The letter, yes, her own Abelard. Without ever imagining how such a thing might come to pass, Eloise had long assumed that the day would arrive when they would once again turn toward each other. How could Abbot Suger's wrathful intervention become an occasion of grace, if not by prompting that very pivot? Eloise knew that Suger's bottomless ambition, not for Saint-Denis, or for King Louis, or for France, but for himself, required the takeover of Argenteuil. Lading traffic on the Seine had exploded in recent decades, carrying goods from Paris to Rouen and beyond, as well as pilgrims by the Legion to and from Chartres. Eloise had been expecting some move from the abbey to exploit the river's double bend at Argenteuil, a landing site, a barrier chain for tolls. And here it was. Suger would fortify the riverbanks and impose tariffs on every passing barge and cog. An endless supply of revenue was the issue, not the scandal given by promiscuous nuns. On Mammon's account, there would be no deflecting the abbot from his course. Even so, Eloise would have fought him to the death if she alone were vulnerable to him. He read her mind, for he said quietly, I will summon each of your sisters to appear before the Metropolitan Tribunal. Your portress, for example, the girl who brought me in, her name is... Eloise did not answer. Celestine, Suger said with a lewd sneer. He could not disguise the pleasure he took in this toying. She will be required, under oath, to account for her night pollutions. What passions have her moaning to the point of communal disturbance? She said, Sister Celestine sleeps soundly. Perhaps so, Mother. But who of us knows what we do in the devil's company at night? All children have scruples. The accusatio can awaken them. Your sisters will be humiliated. One by one. Will you permit that? No, Father, I will not. Eloise stepped back, drawing close to the fountain that stood behind her in the center of the cloister garden. You have the power to desecrate the souls of the good women here, and I see that you will use it, even taking pleasure in the deed. I will not permit that. I see that it is pointless to resist you. Therefore, we will transfer this foundation as you require, surrendering our ancient freehold in Argenteuil. But I will not dissolve this community. I am bound by my oath to the preservation of Notre Dame. I am bound by love to each of its members, Love, in your view, perhaps, is salacious. For us it is sacred. We love the Lord by loving one another, not eros, but agape. Upholding that virtue requires me, as Mother Superior, to make a demand of you. Before obeying your malign command, I must have time to arrange for an alternative conventual domicile. He said, "You will find no such alternative. In which case, your burden will be light. But if I do, Saint-Denis will cover the cost of our reestablishment, not only accommodation for my sisters, but for those of our pledged feudatories who choose to accompany us." He said, "Serfs do not choose." Notre Dame's sworn homage to its servants and laborers stands. I will leave it to them to determine the standing of their sworn fealty. This mutual allegiance carries an obligation that I will fulfill. You will support me in that. Am I clear? Eloise waited. The power she had over this man resided only in her will. But it was power. Finally, Suger said, "Yes." "So, my first requirement is time. My second is provision. My third is discretion. I will not reveal to my sisters what you compel until I know what awaits us. Is that clear?" "Yes." "I will inform you when these preparations are accomplished. Now, Father Abbot, if you please." Eloise gestured again with a sweep of her forearm. "This conference is over." When Abbot Suger had departed, Eloise summoned her chief horseman and instructed him to prepare himself for a long journey. She then went directly to her cell. The complications of what she felt made her lightheaded, and she had to resist the urge to lie down on her cot. The impending loss of Argenteuil staggered her, anguish attached to her own flawed characters having enabled that loss. Her cursed reputation was beyond reckoning. Suger's cruelest thrust was true. The sisters had made themselves vulnerable by electing her as prioress. But desolation was only half of what she felt, for in the thick of contention, a long-shut door had sprung open in her mind at the thought of the Paraclete, his Paraclete. She had just decided to put Peter Abelard's name on the page again, at last. Her heart had leapt at that, a kind of levitation, her flawed character be damned. She prepared her materials quickly, then wrote, "Magistro suo nobilissimo atque doctissimo." She stopped. She knew at once that her choice of grammatical person was wrong. She should not be writing in the third person, but in the first. In her haste, she did not restart the letter, but continued. Peter Abelard would note the change, and would understand it, since, as she now realized for the first time, he had made the same adjustment in the letter she carried at her breast. She wrote, "Fidem meum et cum omni devotione meipsam quam diu vivam." To her most noble and most learned teacher, my faith and my very self with all my devotion as long as I live. The way in which the Paraclete had come to Peter Abelard was peculiar, intimately involving as it did the catastrophe of his mutilation, as well as, in a wholly other context, a mother's declaration that her oldest son was an imbecile. Theobald, the second son of Stephen II, the Count of Meaux and Blois, had, as befit his station in the age of primogeniture, taken the tonsure at a young age, anticipating life as a cleric. He was a bright lad, and at Paris he had embraced the ambition of becoming a master at a school. He had been one of Peter Abelard's most devoted students, and happened to be passing by that dawn when the frantic Eloise summoned him and two others to carry the bloodied master to the physician's house in the Jewish quarter, a trauma Theobald had never wholly shaken. That Peter Abelard had then disappeared from his life had remained a source of grief. Some years later, Theobald's father died of injuries suffered in a joust, and his mother, Adela, boldly declared Theobald's harebrained older brother incapacitated. She appointed Theobald as heir, which is how an Abelard disciple became head of the House of Blois, one of the great dynasties of France. As it happened, that was the year of Abelard's expulsion from Saint-Denis, and Theobald, hearing of that further humiliation of his mentor, had responded with an irrevocable grant of an extensive demesne in the county over which he ruled, plowland, fishing reserves, and leasehold forest sufficient to support a pious enterprise worthy of the great teacher. The Catholic hierarchy in the region was long subservient to the House of Blois, so the local bishop of Troyes had no choice but to sanction the benefice. Hence, the founding of an oratory as a place of prayer, reservation of the Blessed Sacrament, and celebration of Mass, under the aegis of the infamous Peter Abelard. Master Peter welcomed the gift of independence and protection, but, shaken by the forced exile from Saint-Denis, he began at the Paraclete as a reclusive anchorite, renouncing all worldly ambition. He wanted only to be alone. Yet this embrace of ascetic discipline enhanced his reputation with the young scholars who had not forgotten him, and they, together with juniors for whom he was legend, flocked to the Paraclete. The oratory was soon the center of an ad hoc village, part cloister, part academy, part rough encampment, all sunk in a valley that had been cut over eons by a river that was, by now, a meandering, middling stream. For a time, because of the self-invited scholars, Count Theobald imagined himself as the patron of the first important school not sponsored by a cathedral or centered in a city. That was not to be, for the ever more eccentric Abelard discouraged the lads, and after only 2 years, he abandoned the oratory and disappeared. Eventually, word came that he had accepted the commendation, elected as abbot, of an obscure monastery in the uncharted west. Still, the faithful Theobald refused to withdraw support from his mentor. The young count insisted that the grant held, the Paraclete and its lands would perpetually belong to Abelard, or to whomever he conveyed it. Now, once again upon the arrival of the women from Argenteuil, the Paraclete was a hive of activity, with workers busily repairing old structures, the public chapel, hospice, schoolrooms, kitchen, stables, and building new ones, centered on a true monastic cloister, chapter house to the east, choir at the crossing, scriptorium, library, refectory, bathing room, and, on a second story encircling the enclosure, a row of cells for professed sisters. The gray-robed women, with preternatural detachment, observed the hours of the divine office, maintained the great silence, and visibly upheld the contemplative ideal, as if the spinning world of which they were the mystical center were absolutely still. Indeed, the focal point of that world, being built, would be a looming bell tower that would transform the hours into knelling praise. This reconsecration of the Paraclete involved dozens of working men who, in a swarm of activity, tended fires at forges and brickworks, hauled carts, turned a watermill. Masons and thatchers scampered on scaffolding. Carpenters and joiners hoisted timbers. Artisans of various guilds supervised the firing of bricks, the smithing of iron, the cutting of stone, the erection of frames, and the application of lime mortar over wattling. These masters, in turn, were managed by the job steward, who met twice daily with Reverend Mother Eloise in the windowless room adjacent to the cloister that she referred to as her chancery. Bent over its tables, the nun, above a spread of drawings and ledgers, gave instruction to men who had never before taken it from a woman, because she was as competent and sure of what she required as she was respectful. The steward and his craftsmen honored her by obeying. The monastic commune was accomplishing an astounding reinvention. One day, as the steward left her alone in her chancery, Eloise hesitated. Normally, she would have joined her sisters in the choir for the chanting of the mid-afternoon office, but she stalled, not knowing why. Spread before her was a finely drafted rendering of the timber inner structure of the new barn, and her eyes were fixed on the angled tracing. Yet she was aware of a numinous presence before any actual sensation signaled it. At a soft rap on the door, she said simply, "Come." When she looked up to find Peter Abelard in the threshold, her thought was, "At last." Neither spoke. They looked at each other unblinkingly. Eloise was aware of the heat in her cheeks, and she was sure that his brightened face, too, was a function more of feeling than of sun. He was taller than she remembered. The door frame made him stoop. She had always imagined seeing him at this moment as if he were young, his expression glad with the fervor of their just finished play. But his mouth was unhappily clenched, his skin was blotched, and the dust of an unforgiving conscience, like an unkind wind upon the sea, shuddered across the pool of his eyes. When, finally, he said, "Reverend Mother," a tremor in his voice made it wholly unfamiliar. She surprised them both by laughing. "You call me Mother?" He was taken aback. "What then, sister?" Without thinking, she answered, "Call me wife, dear Peter. In my sleep, I call you husband." Now his eyes fell, conveying that this was what he'd dreaded. How quickly she had pierced to their conundrum. "We are full awake here," he said. "Wakefulness requires prudence." This sternness, she realized, was mainly with himself. His brow was lined, and the dark stain of weariness made hollows of his eye sockets. Time had touched him roughly. He said, "Although seeing what you have done with the Paraclete is like a dream, I come here from meeting with Count Theobald. It is no wonder that he is pleased." She said, "Count Theobald is gracious, but you, Peter Abelard, are my true benefactor. I am glad to thank you. It was impudent of me to write to you of my distress. I was desperate. You rescued us." At her gesture, he stepped into her room so that he could stand straight, but he remained by the door. She remained seated at her table. He said, "I was appalled to learn of what Suger did to you at Argenteuil. If you had not made your direct request, I would not have dared propose this solution. I am glad of your request." She said, "You proposed your solution through Theobald. It was rude of you not to answer my letter direct to me. All these years, not a word of consolation from you, nothing. How is that? Once, letters flew between us." "Yes," she said, "I have saved your every one, have you?" "Saved your letters?" he asked. Yes, have you? He blushed. It is a womanly thing to do. I am not a woman. You have not answered my question.